Yes, indeed, the net is now. The net has never been 8:30. The Monday night net is 8:30. The computer net is 8:30. But the technical net has been starting at 8 o'clock for a long, long time. Anyway, welcome, everyone. I'm AC2GS. My name is Roy. I'm the control operator for this, the Limewire technical net. It's been going on for about 44 years now. Every Sunday night at around 8 o'clock, we meet in front of our radios and we exchange ideas and teach each other and learn from each other and entertain each other. And I welcome you all back again this Sunday night when we'll try and do this all over again. Let me drop for a second and I will return and give you the usual links. If you would like to reach me via email, that would be for mailbag questions, and we actually have a mailbag question tonight for probably the first time in a couple of years. Or if you have a TechNet puzzle that you want me to share with the rest of the people to stimulate some discussion, or if you have an expertise in a technology in the news and you'd like to share it with us, or if you'd like me to tap Paul on the shoulder and ask him to take a look at a NASA or space-related story and comment on it. His email address, if you want to go direct, is spacenetreport@gmail.com. My email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Also, as always, I keep a link page open. I cut and paste interesting articles that I've read throughout the week, put it on a link page, and make it available to everyone for the foreseeable future. You just have to type into your browser, roy.ac2gs.com, and the link page will pop up. We have a chat room available if people are so inclined. In the old days, it used to be very, very active. Now, occasionally, it erupts, but it's been kind of quiet the last month or two. You can reach it by typing into your browser, chat.ac2gs.com. We offer an audio stream on the Internet of the technical net. We only had it on the, 8 to 11 o'clock hours, but someone asked me to leave it open the rest of the week, so you can listen in to what's going on in Glen Oaks if you're out of radio distance. You can get to that by just typing into your browser, technet.ac2gs.com. And as always, I like to remind people that Mike, KC2NJI, has a great archive site of these technical nets. They go as far back as September of 2006. His site is amateurradio.tv. So avail yourself of the wisdom of many hams who moved out of the area and or, unfortunately, some that have shuffled off this mortal coil and become silent keys. So that's the usual links. I'll drop for a second. I'll be right back, and I'll tell you what we got planned. Okay, got a couple of words on AI, artificial intelligence, nothing particularly special, but just want to keep everyone up to date. Then we're going to have pretty much the usual smorgasbord. We'll ask for people to get on a list if you have a question or a comment or a topic. I would prefer the first to be amateur radio related. We'll write down the list, the first people to check in. On the list, we'll have the option to go first. Before the list, though, comes the a mailbag question, since we haven't had one in years. So someone wrote me a letter and included a question about something. So we'll address it. Won't take that long. Then we'll go to the usual question comment list. That should take us hopefully to approximately 10:15, and Paul WS2N will join us for the SpaceNet report. That should take us approximately to 11 p.m., and I will return to tie a bow on everything and wish you well for the coming week. So that's the plan. If everything works out right and nothing breaks, God knows things have broken in the past, but hopefully we will have a non-problematic session tonight, and I won't be dropped off of All-Star, which is my mode of transmission here tonight. We'll see how things go. I wish us all a happy little TechNet tonight. So let me drop and give my 2 cents worth on AI. Okay, it's nothing amazing has been reported. People are still churning and offering pseudo new news. They're building better models with smaller footprints, much like DeepSeek. They have a I think it's another Chinese model that was trained with less utility than DeepSeek, and these AI models are getting smarter to a degree, but they're getting more efficient and they're getting smaller. Eventually, they might fit on regular PCs with a good graphics card. You never know. OpenAI announced that for people who are paying them $200 a month for the Pro package, they're including a agent that will operate in a browser. In other words, you can open up a browser and ask ChatGPT to actually do something on the internet, and it will go through the web browser. It can order things. It could buy things. It could provide you with information about things. It has some safety guards that it's not going to give people your credit card number without your approval. So if anyone is rich enough to pay $200 a month for the AI OpenAI Pro, became available a few days ago. So that's about it for artificial intelligence. Let's go on with making up the list. And as I mentioned before, when we get the list made up, at the top of it is a mailbag question, which shouldn't be that long, and hopefully will be useful to some of you out there. Anyway, we're open for business. If you have a question, a comment, or a topic for discussion, hit that push to talk. Give me your first name, your call sign, and what's the nature of what you got for us tonight.
Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu, Ham Radio.
Enter XCN, Ham Radio related.
WA2VDH, TV repair comments.
Okay, anyone else want to put their name on the list?
Second phone.
Yes.
AAC2PL, 1AI comment.
Okay, Jet recognized. Let's go to the mailbag, because, geez, I was kind of amazed. It wasn't really posed as a mailbag, except that, the person wrote us and said that they listened on the technical net, but for some reason they can't seem to get into the repeater, and that they also had this question, and wouldn't it be nice if I mentioned it on one of the technical nets? So I thought I would kind of turn it into basically a mailbag question. The person, Colt, K2OLT, has a question about Chirp. Chirp is a freeware programming application for handy talkies. Primarily, I believe they're designed for the non-DMR. I've recently heard people kind of wishing that they made it operational for DMR. It might have been fixed since then. I don't know. Anyway, the problem is that the question is, how do they find out what COM port do they set Chirp at? Now, Chirp programs the way all the other software works. You get a programming cable, hopefully a legitimate one and not a counterfeit one. You plug it into a computer. It then emulates a RS-232 serial interface that was very popular 20, 30 years ago. And you set the COM port setting on the software, and that allows you to either read or write from the radio to the software. And the problem seems to be, how do you know what COM port to set it at? Let me drop for a sec. Now, I believe they're using a Windows 10 operating system, so it shouldn't be that difficult. You basically need something called the Device Manager. It's in the control panel, which can be found in the Start window at the lower left-hand corner. So run Control Panel, look for Device Manager, pick Device Manager. You'll see Port and LPT as one of the listed types of devices. If you click on it, it'll open up, and it will give you the current devices that are emulating RS-232 interfaces. If you have a very simple system, that should be a programming cable that you have for that you're going to plan to use Chirp for. If you have a lot of emulators, you might want to disconnect your programming cable and see that one of the listed devices disappear, and then when you plug it back into your computer, it appears again. And it'll say if it's COM1 or COM2 or COM3 or COM4, but that's usually the best way of figuring out which COM port is being emulated in your computer from your programming cable. So, you know, with the programming cable plugged in, go back to Chirp and open the window where it offers you to select a specific COM port on your system. Choose that COM port, and you should be good to go. Now, unfortunately, Chirp isn't 100% perfect. Sometimes, even with the proper COM port, it's not working. Very often, it's because you're using a counterfeit programming cable. If you ever look for the price of programming cables, you'll find there's a disparity in the price at some points where there is some place where you know they'll sell it to you for $6. And when you're buying a programming cable for $6, it usually means that the emulator for the USB and RS-232 is counterfeit. And if you just so happen to have a driver that can detect it, the company that manufactures it legitimately is kind of sneaky. Their driver doesn't tell you that it's a counterfeit serial device. It simply doesn't tell you anything. It just doesn't work. So if you're having problems with a programming cable and you spent $6 for it, consider buying a somewhat more expensive one that probably is more legitimate. So assuming that it's a legitimate chip, I think Prolific and FTDI are major manufacturers of those type of conversion chips. But if you have a legitimate one, then the other suggestion I would make would be sometimes you got to kind of prime the pump. You can't just set up Chirp sometimes and then output it, have it write to your handy-talkie. The best approach is to have it read from your handy-talkie initially, and that tends to often initialize the software and make it able to work. So once you read from the radio, you can then change the settings and then hopefully write to the radio and get Chirp to work for you. So I hope you're listening out there.
F2CC.
Okay, hopefully, yeah, I'm back. I'm sorry, I fell out of All-Star, and it's only 8:16. Anyone want to tell me at one point I fell out so I can finish the thought?
Everything in half. I think you completed your sentence with the FTDI and Prolific.
Oh, okay, so that's in case you have a stolen chip or a fake chip. Also, one of the problems that I've noticed with Chirp is that sometimes it needs to be primed. So before it kind of likes to write to the handy talkie, it requires you to read from the handy talkie. So the best approach is when you get the proper COM port, if you still have problems, try instead of writing to the handy talkie, try reading from the handy talkie, and that sometimes primes the pump. So that was my advice. I hope you're out there. If you didn't take notes and you missed some of this, of course, as always, Mike over at amateurradio.tv will have this audio up in, I don't know, a week or so, and you can listen to it again. Anyone with any comments, please feel free.
CAF 2CC checking in. AC2PL coming.
Yes, welcome aboard, Brian, and well, Jeff, yes, you want to say something?
Yeah, Roger. When I've used Chirp before, or at least kind of the first few times I used it, I was making the mistake of first, kind of silly, stupidly not having the radio on. Of course, it needs to be on. But also the volume needs to be up a little bit. I think it's actually communicating using the signal coming out of the radio. Or that's at least what I imagined and read somewhere. So on and volume up.
Okay, I never heard the volume up. I assume that, you know, it was designed the way most of these other programming systems, and it's just it's spitting out ASCII because it's basically operating at the level of an RS-232 interface, and that doesn't allow for audio. It just gives you ASCII, but anything's possible, but I thank you.
Comment.
Yes, Brian?
I used Chirp. I'm sorry. Ah. I used Chirp, and it's very, very good. I also like to use a FTDI chip for the prolific preference on the FTDI chip. I find it's more reliable. And lastly, I like RT Systems programming software. It's just more polished, but you can get around that. You don't have to use it.
Yeah, I also prefer RT Systems. I don't mind paying for a commercial manufacturer to keep the software up to date. He also has massive number of models that his software covers, and they're cut and pastable across different radios, and they are also capable of coding for DMR, which is a very useful feature. So Prolific and FTDI are the major two manufacturers of legitimate chips. Unfortunately, both of them have been pirated and copied all over the place. And like I said, if you go to Amazon and look for the cheapest programming cable, or especially eBay, there's a reason why those programming cables are less than $8. It's, you know, because someone kind of just pirated the darn things. And I would have preferred it FTDI would simply recognize that it was a pirated chip and say, you can't use that with this driver, to kind of give a little bit less grief to the average amateur radio operator. But apparently they are interested in creating grief, so I guess you won't try that trick again. But thank you for that, Brian.
Are we ready for the Joker season?
Say again?
Are we ready for the joke of the evening?
Okay, if you got a joke for us, we always like to start the net in a good mood.
There are two snakes sitting next to each other, a male and a female snake. And the male says to the female snake, you know, I've been thinking about us. Are we venomous? And she goes, of course we're venomous. He
He goes, why would you ask such a stupid question? And the male snake says, because I just bit my lip.
Okay. Okay, well, let's move on with the next segment. Rich, what do you got for us tonight?
Yeah, this is W2BZ. Good evening, everybody. Good evening, Roy. I built that vertical antenna that is just a wire going into the center conductor of coax for 10 meters, this is, for another 8 feet. Then into a choke. The design I used called for the choke, 24 turns on a 2-inch core. I didn't have a 2-inch core, I had a 1-inch core, and I wound 24 turns around the 1-inch core. Since it's not a loading coil, it's a choke, is there anything that I did wrong by doing the same amount of turns, but on a 1-inch piece of PVC rather than a 2-inch piece of PVC? That's the question, Roy.
Not particularly. I mean, you didn't use any kind of ferrite core for that? You know, circular type of ferrite? It's just an air choke?
I have both. I used a ferrite core, 43 compound ferrite core, but that was more for noise reduction. But the 24 turns is just an air choke.
I'm deeply confused at this point. So you basically have two chokes. You have an air core with windings, and then you just have another ferrite material someplace along the line?
I thought the ferrite material, which is right next to the 24 turns air core choke, I thought the ferrite would help with noise reduction. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, I mean, it would provide for a better RF choke. So theoretically, if I was doing it, if I had already a toroid, I would simply use the toroid and wind the coax cable around the toroid. You could never have too much choking of common mode. In a perfect world, you would want no common mode beyond that point, because you want the common mode to radiate at the lower leg of your kind of pseudo dipole. So it sounds a little redundant. Again, if I was doing it, I would just wind it around the toroid and call it a day.
How many winds would you use for a choke?
Well, the more the merrier. You're obviously going to run out of space in the center of the toroid, but you know, every time you loop it, you improve the attenuation by the number of loops squared. So, you know, if you have two loops, it's the same as four times the attenuation. If you have three loops going around it, it's nine. And so, you know, the numbers rather increase quickly. So, the more the merrier, as long as there's room and you're not crushing the coax cable.
Comment?
Sure, Jeff.
At one point in time, Roy, sorry to interrupt, but I have some information which is directly pertinent to this. At one point in time, I found a table which listed a large number of ferrite cord and, air cord common mode chokes. And I grabbed that table and I reproduced it in my QRZ page. And it's got a lot of great information. It's all the way at the bottom of my QRZ page, so you can skip all the nonsense and go until you see a green and red and yellow table. It's got a ton of great information. So AC2PL on QRZ, there's a little table at the bottom of my page. Go so.
Okay, very good, Jeff. So you heard Rich. Check out Jeff's QRZ page. And ultimately, you know, if you have one common mode RF choke, you don't really need a second one. I mean, theoretically, if you need more choking, you could always put them in series with each other. But like I said, you could probably get a significant impedance to common mode transmission, just by a relatively smaller number of loops around the ferrite toroid.
Well, what happened was I originally wound the toroid with 9 loops, but it moved the SWR of the antenna up to 30 megahertz. So one by one, I unwrapped the toroid, and I looked at the SWR, and it got down to three turns around the toroid, and hit exactly on the 10-meter band where I wanted it to. So I left it at 3 turns on the toroid. I figured, you know, it couldn't hurt anything. And I will take a look at, I think it's Jeff, your QRZ page. There's also an article that I downloaded that I didn't read yet, and it was called The Myth About RF. Or no, The Myth About Grounding. I haven't read it yet, but I will. So, anyway, like I said, since now it's bang on SWR-wise, I will try to use it that well. And it tunes up at a 1.4 to 1 without any tuner or anything. Just a 1.4 to 1 SWR, which is right where I want it. Go ahead, Roy.
Okay, very good. I wish you luck on it. That's a 10-meter vertical. So, again, 10 meters is quite active. Not that active this morning, unfortunately. I mean, we talked about this before. It was last Sunday, the ARRL had a DX, worldwide DX contest, and it brought a lot of operators out. 10 meters was an insane asylum. There wasn't any place to park. Today, unfortunately, or fortunately, there's a lot of places for me to place my 10-meter net. I think there was maybe 2 or 3 conversations going on in the visible range of the 10-meter band that I was looking at. So, although propagation is probably still good, because I talked to Florida, I talked to Texas, but, you know, there were very few and far between. Everyone was, I guess, resting up from the contest last Sunday.
Yeah, today the band was dead. You know, I get this antenna up. I'm all excited. I have a vertical now as opposed to the shortened end-fed half-wave, which has been just a great antenna for me. It loads up on 80 through 10. Amazing. With an antenna tuner, of course. But it's just amazing. Oh, one other question. If you use the Riggs antenna tuner and another antenna tuner, you're in essence tuning an antenna tuner, right? With the Riggs antenna tuner, you're just tuning the antenna tuner.
Yeah, we talked about this before. It's generally frowned upon to run 2 impedance matching circuits in serial with each other, especially if they are auto tuning. Then they can go quite crazy, because, you know, one will find out that the tuning isn't perfect and adjust, which will wake up the other one, which then changes, which confuses the first one, which confuses the second one, and it just kind of, it can go crazy. So all things being equal, it's usually good practice to keep it one impedance transforming device on an antenna system at a time. Don't do multiple. We talked in the past about how, you know, sometimes you felt that one of your antenna tuners didn't have the ability to offer enough of an impedance transform, and so you added a second one on it to kind of push it to a point that you would prefer. But generally speaking, not a good practice.
Yeah, what I found on YouTube, there's a lot of misinformation about tuners on the 7300. people show that with an external antenna tuner, you engage the tuner in the 7300, but that's false. I take the tuner in the 7300 out of the circuit, really, to confuse matters a little bit. If I can't get a good match with the external antenna tuner, if I can't get it low enough, I just hit the internal antenna tuner, and then I take it out of the circuit again, because for some reason, the internal antenna tuner helps the external antenna tuner get to a lower SWR. I don't know why it does that, but it does that. And the external antenna tuner is supposedly an automatic antenna tuner, but sometimes it doesn't go low enough unless I goose it along with the 7300's internal antenna tuner and then take the internal antenna tuner out of the circuit. That's what I found works for me. Go ahead, Roy.
AC2GS. Well, as I've often mentioned before, YouTube is a useful resource, but let the buyer beware. There's no one checking on anyone's work. So it's perfectly possible to find a physics channel. I found one where it was a doctoral student who got things wrong. It's possible, and ham radio has a higher incidence than I found personally. I haven't done anything really scientific and accurate, but just generally speaking, you unfortunately comes close to kind of tossing a coin whether or not the guy that you're listening to has the faintest idea what he's talking about. So I'm a little bit wary of ham radio YouTubes. We talked about that the other night, and you learned a lot about how the 7300 operates, but you never quite know when some guy who doesn't know what he's talking about is just making up stuff. So, you know, it could be, you know, things like that. Now, getting back to what you mentioned about your radios and tuning, I don't quite understand how you could kind of switch it out once you use it and it still has anything left to change how your external antenna tuner works. Although, as I've mentioned in the past, antenna tuners work in mysterious ways. They use different impedance transforming circuitry, pi networks, L networks, T networks, and they all have slightly different characteristics, and based upon the capacitors and inductors, they have different ranges that they can transform impedances. They're best demonstrated on Smith's charts, but absolutely no manufacturer offers a Smith's chart to figure these things out. So one of the weirdnesses of antenna tuners is, and I've had this happen to me in the past, I've been unable to transform the impedance to 50 ohms, and I introduce, especially something with a relatively small wavelength, like 10 meters, I've introduced 3, 4, 5 foot jumpers in the antenna transmission line that rotates the impedance so that the absolute impedance remains the same, but the vectors change, the degree changes, such that at one vector the antenna tuner can't convert it to 50 ohms, and with the jumper it can. So maybe it introduces an artificial electrical length that rotates the impedances into a range that your antenna tuner can handle. Perhaps that's what's going on.
AT2RY.
Yes, Wes recognized, David recognized, Wes first, and then David.
Yeah, it's just a subject you touched. So I have a question. Do you think that it is better to have antenna tuner built into your radio, or the one that is mounted at the antenna and connected with the coax and additional cable is the better option? And to
exchange. Comment. Well, it sort of depends upon the quality of your antenna tuner. You can theoretically Your manufacturer can build an antenna tuner just as good internally than anything you could buy externally. It's a lot easier, though, to buy an external antenna tuner that's bigger and sturdier, because there's you know, there's volume limitations and other kind of technical limitations on internal antenna tuners in modern day relatively small base stations. But I mean, theoretically, it doesn't really matter. It has more to do with the use of components and what kind of circuits are used in the impedance transformation circuits.
VDH with a comment. Comment.
Okay, we got a line here. Let's go in order, and hopefully I won't forget anyone. So Wes, did I answer your question?
Well, you stated your opinion on it. I believe the antenna tuner there is mounted directly on the dipole. If we have a dipole, matches the impedance of the antenna to the coaxial cable, that is 50 ohms, and it is already the match into the transceiver or transmitter if you transmit, and the antenna tuner that is mounted on the antenna has much more room than it is in the average radio that people would like to be small. So there is more room to have much more sophisticated antenna tuner mounted outside than one inside. And in addition to it, you may use two of them, the one that is at your radio and the other one that is at your antenna. Do you agree with that, Antoine?
Yeah, that's basically what I just finished saying. There's no inherent limitation to the size of a internal antenna tuner inside your radio, but usually when people are selling, manufacturing and selling radios, they like to keep it compact. So that introduces a limitation. There's another limitation that has nothing to do with either separate, well, inherently separate or combined, and that's where you put the antenna tuner in relation to the antenna system you have. The optimal place to put it is right at the antenna feed point because of the losses in reflection and attenuation loss between the antenna feed point and your shack, where both of the antenna tuners are usually located, especially in this particular question.
I completely agree. Thank you very much, Dr. Wright.
You're welcome. David, you're next. You wanted to say something.
Yes, sir. Good evening, everybody. I have a fan dipole, 40 through 10, resonant on 40, 20, 15, and 10. And 100 feet of RG213, an external tuner, and an internal tuner inside the radio. I use the internal tuner for the resonant bands, 40, 20, 15, and 10. And I use the external tuner for 17 and 12. And it works really well. What I do is I take the external tuner and put it in bypass mode, and then I can use the internal tuner. Then if I want to use the external tuner, I use them only on band 17 and 12. What do you think about that, Dr. Roy?
Well, it's certainly an option. Unless there's something magical about the built-in radio tuner. I mean, one of the big pluses generally for built-in radio tuners is you can take them out, say, a field day or something. You don't have to deal with two separate components. You only have one component. So, you know, there's nothing inherently magical about the internal one. You could get into the habit of using your external tuner for all of them. My guess would be the external tuner has a somewhat wider range. Internal tuners usually are Japanese, and the Japanese have this weird idea that, you know, you shouldn't really have an antenna that's any more than 3 to 1 SWR. So whereas external antenna tuners are capable of correcting impedance mismatches to a point of 10 to 1 sometimes, the internal antenna tuners built into Japanese radios tend to be, you know, less capable of wider corrections. But, I mean, you know, theoretically you could do it all with your external if you were so inclined. But you could use the internal for one set of bands and the external for the other set of bands, just as long as you bypass one of them at a time. And, you know, not let both of the antenna tuners kind of bang into each other.
Yeah, but the internal tuner is very stable, solid, stable. You know, I really like to use it, especially on 40 and 10. And what to say, the other bands, well, for this radio, the internal tuner is quite fantastic.
Okay, it's your option. You can do it that way. You can do it, again, as long as you don't do both of them at the same time, and if you need one, you don't do none of them at the same time. But it's up to you. You own both of them. You control both of them. You can select which one you use in the same way that, you know, people with a lot of different radios can select what radio they want to use for what circumstances. It's, you know, it's all good.
I learned that the way to do this, you know, the thing that makes it possible is the bypass button on the external tuner. Thank you, Dr. Roy.
BDH with a comment?
Yes, John.
Yeah, actually, you touched on it just that a transmission or two ago. The thing to remember is that between the antenna tuner and the antenna, the SWR is still high. The antenna tuner makes the system look good to the look like 50 ohms to the transmitter, but on the other side of the antenna tuner is the high SWR. So it would make sense. Therefore, as far as Wesley's question, to have the antenna tuner as close as possible to the antenna, so you have the minimum length of cable which is experiencing the high SWR and associated high losses. To the question of the gentleman that just commented about using the internal antenna tuner for one and the external for the other, yeah, if it's a band where you have high SWR, it makes sense to use the antenna tuner that's closest to the antenna, whereas on bands where the SWR is lower or more reasonable, then you probably, you know, you're better off using the internal one. You can get away with using the internal one in the rig. But the thing to remember is that after the antenna tuner, the SWR is still high.
Comment?
Yes, Brian.
I didn't want to interrupt. I just want to put myself in queue.
Oh, okay. I'll put you down on the list.
The question I had, the queue is right now. That comes next.
I'm confused. We're doing. We're answering Rich. Then we have Wesley, then we have John, then we have Jeff, then we have you. Is that okay?
That's fine. I just had some comments to make on antenna tuners, but I'll wait.
No, we're talking about antenna tuners, so you could mention your thoughts.
I thank you, Roy, because I wanted to get into the right position. I don't know if you heard me, but that's okay. Antenna tuners are a very interesting breed of dog, so to speak. I mean, I've used internal, I've used external, and the other gentleman, I didn't get his call sign, I apologize, had made an excellent point about from the antenna tuner to the actual antenna itself.
I'm using a random wire NFET at the current moment. I'll be upgrading that in the spring. But nevertheless, if my SWR goes anywhere above 1.0, I get RFI on the side of my home that turns on my dryer, my china closet lights, affects my television, and I've used many ferrite cores with varying success, but I have not been able to completely remediate the problem. So, in essence, basically, you have RFI coming from that additional SWR that's amplified if you have, obviously, if you have an amplifier, that's going to even increase the intensity of that. So there are complications that do arise with SWR, not just for power output reflection, but also for radio frequency interference.
Okay. Having a mismatch, the point of having resonance is to have an impedance match, which optimizes the energy transfer from your transmission line to your radiating antenna. In a perfect world, you would want 100% of the power that you send out your transmission line to go into your radiator and have your antenna radiate all that energy as the radiation resistance, which is basically the energy is transferred to radio waves and radiated across the country. If you have a non-resonance or an impedance mismatch at the antenna feed from the nominal 50 ohms that your transmission line and transmitter is expecting, you will get reflections back into your system that could go as far back as your transmitter's output circuit, which could damage them theoretically if they don't have proper protective circuitry. So that's the point of the RF choke, is to cause a high impedance against common mode current that is being reflected back at the antenna feed because of the mismatch. So you can attenuate it to a degree with RF chokes, but RF chokes are not binary devices, so they don't, by necessity, produce a complete absence of common mode. The higher the impedance of the RF choke, the higher decibel drop of the common mode current going back and acting as a secondary antenna that's located inside your shack and causing you all this problem. So ultimately, you know, you may benefit from multiple RF chokes at the antenna feed point to lessen the amount of reflection common mode radiation. I think that goes to your comment and your question. You know, some people have a lot, some people have a little, and as was mentioned earlier, optimally, every time you get a reflection, you get the common mode current, which acts as a radiator, which floods your shack with RF that causes more problems than anything else. In addition, every time the reflections go back and forth, you add up the attenuation losses inherent in all coaxial cables. No coaxial cable is perfectly lossless. So every time it travels back and forth for a given length and for a given frequency, a certain amount of decibels are lost as waste heat. So that's two problems of a mismatch. If you apply your antenna tuner directly at the feed point and operate it remotely and shield it from the weather, that's usually the best case, because any kind of impedance mismatch will only occur at the antenna feed point with very little opportunity to reflect back and to have any additional attenuation loss. But you have to weatherproof them and you have to remote control them, and most people just put them in their shack and deal with the reflections.
Easy.
Yes, Rich?
I saw a very interesting demonstration on YouTube where a guy set up a nano VNA and measured if two ferrite
beads were better than one, if three ferrite beads were better than two, up to seven ferrite beads. And one thing I learned is you just don't take a ferrite bead and clamp it around a cable. It's better to get a bigger ferrite bead and make up to three loops through the ferrite bead and then clamp it down. Anyway, he absolutely demonstrated on the nano VNA that seven ferrite beads in series is better than five, five is better than three, and three is better than one.
Okay, but as I mentioned earlier, there's a linear relationship to ferrite beads. And you mentioned two is better than one, three is better than two, and on and on and on we go. If you go use a torus and you loop the transmission line of, you know, if you loop them twice, instead of getting twice the benefit, you get the square of the number of loops, which means you get four times the benefit. So if you have, say, five beads serially, one after the other, you know, that gives you kind of five times the impedance. If you have a toroid with five loops around it, you get five squared, which is 25 times the impedance.
Yeah, well, like I said at the beginning of this, I have both. Well, the choke isn't doing the same thing as the, well, you said it was, that the choke is doing the same, is doing the same function as the core is doing, the ferrite core. But RFI, the gentleman who's having that really bad RFI problem, I would get really big ferrite beads and loop the coax through them three times before you close the ferrite bead, and then put, you know, try two, then try three, see, and then and all the way up to seven. After seven, there was a nominal benefit from adding another ferrite bead, like the eighth ferrite bead. There was a great experiment the guy did with the nano VNA, set up perfectly for this purpose. He used LogMag, he didn't use SWR, to see what the attenuation was. So that's what I would do. I would not just clamp a ferrite bead around a coax, I would loop the coax three times through the ferrite bead. Back to Roy.
Okay, I mean, six of one, half a dozen the other. You know, toroids are very useful if people are so inclined. Depending upon the size of it, the mass of it, you could loop a transmission line around and around a good number of times. You might reach a point of diminishing returns, but if you do, then there's nothing much you can do. You've impeded the common mode current as much as you can, and you know, you're on to the next problem.
Comment.
Yes, Brian?
Okay. In my situation, being that I have a random wire NFED, the coax acts as a radiator. So I have about 25 feet of that, and then I have the ferrites, which looped around four times, actually. And I also have a common mode filter. However, or a common mode choke, I should say. However, that other part of the coax still needs to radiate as part of the antenna, I was told. Otherwise, I could just put, you know, a huge choke right at the transformer feed point, and it would go all along the wire. Am I incorrect, or am I correct?
AC2GS, you are quite correct. The design... There are antennas such as the one that Rich is talking about that he just put up that require common mode operation for a certain length of the coax cable. And your random end-fed is the one that utilizes the transmission line. If you don't give a unbalanced antenna a counterpoise, it will grab one from what it has available, which is usually the coaxial cable. So by limiting the length of the coaxial cable that doesn't have an RF choke, you offer your antenna system a useful counterpoise. You have to realize, of course, that that length of transmission line is a radiating antenna. So you should try and not have it be too close to your shack. Otherwise, even if you block all the common mode beyond the choke, you can still get RF into your shack. RF can get, you know, even an antenna. If you put a strong, high-powered antenna 2 feet away from your shack, chances are it's going to flood your shack and all kinds of strange things will happen. So you got to keep in mind that everything up until that choke is a radiating antenna and should be a reasonable length into the far field so that you don't get too much RF in your shack interacting usually not with radios as much as computers and other devices that weren't designed for that amount of radiating RF in their environments.
Exactly. And that's the problem I have, because the dryer that I have is microprocessor controlled. So therefore, you know, I put mix 75 and mix 31s right on the AC line, looped through, and that was of no value. And then I took off the cover of the dryer, and I saw the control board, and then I put little chokes, each one on every individual line, wrapping them where there was enough wire to go ahead and wrap around. That did not resolve it. So I'm thinking, would a Faraday cage or something that I could construct be of benefit, or am I just better off with a on-off switch on when I want to use the dryer and off when I'm using my radio?
Well, I would give it a chance. Faraday cage covering the microprocessor. I would leave the RF chokes there. You know, they can't cause any harm. But I would try the Faraday cage as well.
Right, but here's the question: how do you build a little Faraday cage to go around a circuit board, basically, that was never shielded properly in the first place?
Yes, Wes, one second. Have you ever popped open some computers, but basically a lot of radios, where there's a metal box that's being used just as a Faraday cage?
Correct.
Well, it's the same principle. You get some high mu metal, you bend it into a box. You might have some problems with the underside, with RF just kind of creeping through the underside, but you might be able to put some insulators between it and the PC board at the bottom, and it might make it tight enough to operate.
But you have to ground it, correct?
Yeah, but I mean, there should be a decent ground wired into the washing machine, so it just means tapping the ground.
Okay. Yeah, I'll investigate doing that, because otherwise what I have to do is really quite simple. I have a switch that shuts the dryer off when I'm using my radios, and then if I want to use, you know, that's the big thing. A lot of these appliances that are made today are, of course, microprocessor controlled versus analog or mechanical even, and they are extremely, extremely susceptible to RFI, even on 100 watts. It's amazing what happens.
Well, it's another one of those cost-saving measures. It costs less money to build microprocessors that are sensitive to RF. It takes additional money to put Faraday cages around sensitive microprocessor circuits where RF can get into them. But since 99.9% of